This is KVSC's Arts and Cultural Heritage producer, Jeff Carmack, and welcome to another installment of the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. Today we're going to be visiting once again with SCSU archivist Tom Stamen, and we're going to chat about three different ways that St. Cloud State University has had an impact on the surrounding community by students through a peace march revolving around the Vietnam War, a long-forgotten and now forbidden tradition, and also by a famous resident of St. Cloud, whose private letters are stored in the archive.
Well, right on. We're back at the university archives, and I'm going to talk about a couple of different things today. As well, you know, we're kind of on the topic of tradition, and well, it's springtime, and you know, what do we do and out and about? So, one of the things I think we're going to talk about first is the Day of Peace that I'm not sure too many people really know about around town. Can you tell us a little bit about the Day of Peace at St. Cloud State University?
You bet, Jeff. It was an event that took place on May 11th, 1972. So we obviously know about the Vietnam War and the protests that were going on as the war was going forward. I think the protest movement probably lost a little steam after Kent State in 1970. But people obviously were very concerned about the ongoing conflict in Vietnam, and Nixon's insistence that he was going to end it, and in fact, he was escalating the war. And people wonder, well, you know, how did the protest or how did that movement affect St. Cloud State? Well, it actually did. There were protests, and one of the biggest ones that I'm aware of was this Day of Peace protest that happened in May 1972.
So that was on campus involving students and all?
That was on campus. It was something that, as I was reading a little more about this recently, the student government had wanted to have an event. The faculty senate at the time voted to support this event, and President Charles Graham gave his support for it, or designated it as a day of peace. And classes were not canceled that day, but he said, well, this is a day of peace. The administration, you know, isn't supporting it, but, you know, we'll designate it, and then the students and whoever can do what they want to do. So the students did organize themselves, and they also got the College of St. Benedict students involved, as well as those at St. John's University, and they planned an event for that day. So the event was to march from Atwood, Stuart Hall area, over to Lake George as a peaceful protest. So that's and I could talk a little more about the details. I don't know if you have any questions, Jeff, so far. But.
Well, yeah, so what ended up happening during this?
It was a peaceful protest. Yeah. It was interesting because there are some, I was looking at the Chronicle this morning, and there's many images and many stories around that time regarding that specific protest. And they ended up taking, I have no idea why, but they took a detour to the federal building on St. Germain downtown, and they hung around there, and the police were ready for them. There's images of armed riot police standing in front of the doors of the federal building, and that was at the time they were making, I don't know if they call it Mall Germain anymore, but it was, was it a pedestrian mall the whole time? Yeah. But obviously now it isn't so much anymore, but it's interesting as these students march to the federal building and they're talking to the construction workers because they're building the Mall Germain, and there's this giant hole there and there's mounds of dirt, and I'm not really quite sure what happened there, but they ended up finding their way to Lake George. Though along the way they were in the street handing out pamphlets and brochures to passerbys and those who were traveling by car. And they had a rally at Lake George, and they had some folks who were involved with the peace movement. I read the names. I have no idea who they are, but they had this large rally, and from the accounts of the newspaper, there were 700-800 people who were involved with this protest.
Well, it's pretty impressive, you know, with not just Well, that's pretty impressive on the level of student involvement. You know, that was quite the movement there. Let's see. So they got to Lake George, and you know, I imagine they had speeches and whatnot. And yeah. But how long did this whole thing go on?
You know, I'm not even quite sure. I don't know. I don't know. But the interesting part of it is we have the university photographer had taken I don't know how many hundreds of photos, and on our Archon portal, as well as on Minnesota Reflections, which is the web portal for Minnesota Digital Library, there are images of that day of the students protesting, the students at Atwood, students at the federal building, students at Lake George, carrying signs, you know, marching along, I don't know if it was Division Street. I'm not from St. Cloud, I'm not really quite sure where they were exactly marching. But there's hundreds of photos, and we have a good plenty of them scanned and available for people to use and download.
Nice, and they can find people can find that on the website at the Archives website.
Yep, they can find it on the Archives website. We also have images from the Chronicle that appeared in the Chronicle. I have not taken a look at them specifically. I know that they are there, but the University Chronicle has many, many, many images from that same protest. So there was an article in the Chronicle shortly afterwards, and it was from President Graham. Maybe it might have been a letter, but he was thanking the students for being peaceful and being orderly and conducting themselves, you know, in a good behavior, I guess. But he was worried that there could have been disruptions on campus, and the students were peaceful, and they went about their business. The university was able to do their business as well.
Nice, nice. Yeah, that is kind of one of those things. You mentioned Kent State had happened just before then, and so the political climate is very different than it is today. You know, that kind of reminds me, recently, a couple years ago, the LGBT community had they've had a couple of marches, just about like equality, the marriage equality, and then there was I think that was a big part of it, where, you know, they gathered here on campus at the Atwood Mall, and then it was a summer day. I remember it being very, very hot, and they marched down Division Street, you know, a little bit of a ways, and then they got to a point, and then they turned around and marched back, and by the time they got back, everybody was exhausted. But, you know, it's you know, everybody's got signs, everybody's being happy, everybody's, getting people to honk at them, and there's no, you know, animosity out there. There's no, nobody was trying to threaten anybody with anything. And it seems to be a good way to do a march, you know, where, you know, conversely, way back then, everybody was nervous because, you know, everybody's getting all worked up, and, you know, the end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s, you know, that's when people start protesting things, because I don't recall stuff in like the 50s and 40s and, you know, before then, where it's, you know, you've got 700 students marching about something. I mean, do you remember anything along those lines? I don't. Well, not that we would remember because we weren't alive, but, you know, just throughout history. It's like, I think it's in the 60s where people start actually, hey, let's stop this, you know, and, well, it's kind of neat, I guess, that those things can still happen. You know, there's enough community involvement, and yeah.
So here's more, and they have, you know, they had folks, I don't know who this, Jane Kennedy, I have no idea who that person is, but here she is at Lake George speaking about, you know, the conflict in Vietnam, and here's another with philosophy instructor Myron Anderson. There's others as Adrian Lederman. And these, yes, Berrigan. I have no idea. Niece of the Reverends Daniel and Philip Berrigan. I've never heard of them. These images appear in the Chronicle. I should pull these out.
Yeah, if you could scan a bunch of those and see, that'd be awesome.
Some of these I haven't seen, but then here you have folks who are watching the protest. So members of the community watch were invited by March to join as a group moved down 6th Street to Lake George.
Yeah, people, you know, kind of forget about, you know, that era, you know, unless, Yeah, well, obviously, people who lived through it would remember it, but you know, it was very different. You know, people were getting. Well, I think the difference between there's many differences, but a big difference between the Vietnam War and the current war that is still going on. You know, there's no draft. You know, they kind of took it in a different direction, and then you know, there's I don't know, a different. Different field of the whole thing. So the protests aren't as vitriolic, I guess you could say, you know, so.
And I knew there were other ones, too. And I don't know if it was so much of a protest, and I didn't look into this a little more, but I know that after the Kent State shootings, they had rallies, and there's this great image that we have here from 1970, right after, so it was May 4th or 5th, 1970, when that happened, where they're, I believe they're on West Saint Germain, and people are covering the, you can see people as far as you can, and they're holding signs, and I wasn't sure when this protest had happened. It was obvious some protest. It was obviously St. Cloud, but I didn't know what it was or when it was, and I was able to, I found the image somewhere published and had seen that it was from those. The protest after the Kent State shootings in 1970, and I was glad I was able to find out when that was. But other Vietnam protests, I'm sure there were some. I've never really looked into it more than past the Day of Peace. But I'm sure the students, and I know they were active and obviously concerned about what was going on. And whether or not they had protests of that scale, as I said about the Kent State and then the Day of Peace. You know, I'm not really sure.
Yeah. You're in tune to 88.1 FM KVSC, and in today's installment of the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota, we're chatting with SCSU archivist Tom Stamen. And next we get into a little-known tradition that hasn't been around for a while at St. Cloud State, and after listening, you'll know why.
Well, let's talk about another student tradition, I guess you could say, a tradition which is no more. For various reasons, I imagine there was a swim across the Mississippi.
That's right.
What's up with that?
So this was a tradition started by the El Serrat. This was a local social fraternity, El Serrat, which later became Theta Chi in 1965. And I don't really know why they decided to do it. Maybe it was spring fever at that time, but this tradition started in the spring of 1952. And the tradition was, once the ice went out on the Mississippi River, somebody, and it was someone from El Serrat, Theta Chi, would swim across the river and, you know, rite a passage or something, you know. It was a rite of spring. Mm-hmm. That's what they did. And so it started in 1952, and El Serrat, Theta Chi, had, we believe, they participated every year, if not every year, most years. And they made, not only was it, I think partly it was an excuse to blow off some steam. And it quickly evolved into a pretty major event where they would take the swimmer who would usually swim from the east side over to Munsinger Park. And this usually happened. I did find a date. They did like the very end of March, and there were various times in April that it had been done, and there were some times in May when the swim was done. But there was this whole elaborate thing. It was created pretty quickly, I think, where the swimmer would go into a chariot, and they would pull the chariot to wherever this person was going to be swimming, and they had a greasing up ceremony. So they had, I'm not even sure what they were using, but they would grease the swimmer up to protect them from the cold. So we have photos of, you know, the swimmer being greased up by people who are participating in this event. And then they would swim across over to Munsinger Park or somewhere on the east side of the Mississippi River. And, you know, I know at least later on that they would have boats that would follow the swimmer. But then, so they would have that, but then everyone else would go to the other side of the river, and they would go over there and have a party.
Yeah, having boats, always nice to be safety first about that.
Yeah, safety first.
I was kind of recounting before we started recording that, you know, I live on the river and my friends do a river cleanup and I've participated with that. And I have jumped into the river in, you know, mid-May, and it is not a pleasant experience. Whereas you wait a little bit later, you know, once you hit beginning of June, then it's nice and cool and refreshing. So if they're doing this in April, wow. Yeah, that's pretty potent. So how long did this go on?
Well, this tradition continued on in 1977. I think it sort of got bigger, and there were other fraternities and sororities who got involved. So there were – I had my staff person research this a few years ago just to get any information we could from the Chronicle about the event. And so El Serrat was sort of like the main one. But then there were others who decided, you know what, I'm going to swim it this year before the fraternity does. And there were other years where there were other fraternities who did participate, and there were women from sororities who would also swim across the river too. And I don't think it wasn't a race. It was just, you know, we did it first. Mm. We did it first. And it continued on until 1977. And that year, the swimmer who was recruited to do it, that was like a tactful way to say it, but he had gone into the river, and about halfway through they had pulled him out. He had passed out. He went into shock, and there's photos that we have. They're pulling this guy out of the water, and he couldn't continue on. And then the information came out about that this gentleman was legally drunk, and we have a photo. This guy is—you see him before him swimming, was drinking a beer, and I don't know. It must have been like April sometime when he had done this. So, because of that, you know, and there was—I've never found anything ever official about it, but mm-hmm. It seemed that that what had happened in 1977 effectively ended that tradition. Because I would never in a million years swim that. I'm not saying I'm not a strong swimmer, but you know, if it's cold, I'm not interested at all.
Well, I do it in June or July or August or September, but maybe not even September. It starts to change in September, but yeah. April? No. But yeah, I could see that. You got a tradition that's going on for a while until somebody, well, you know, makes a poor choice, and then it gets people's attention, and the people are just like, you know what, this ends now before somebody dies, you know, so.
And I know there were other instances, too. I remember reading that folks, this one gentleman, he got tired, and I think that he'd hung onto the boat, or they had pulled him in, and then he warmed up, or he, you know, got some more energy and went across the river. But I'm not saying that there were others who had partied a little bit before they had swam. I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case, but you know, with someone nearly dying in 1977, I can see how that kind of tradition would kind of peter out. You know, I really think it's a neat tradition, and when I first found out about it, I was really, really intrigued. I'm like, well, that's appropriate, you know, because the university sort of turns its back to the river a bit, and here the students are celebrating the rite of spring, and the ice is finally, you know, flowed down the Mississippi River, and they're going to do something to celebrate that, and to blow off a little steam too.
Yeah, a little pre-finals week, hooting and hollering and everything. I could see that. Well, you know, just to reiterate to everybody, do not jump in the river. might sound like a good idea at the time, but most disasters do sound like a good idea at the time. And yeah, it's actually when I kayak, there's a 100-degree rule that you kind of follow. So the air temperature plus the water temperature should equal at least 100 degrees before you get into the water. And that's just in a kayak, because you know, if you flip, if you fall out, or just, you know, really if you get wet, that cold will get you. And it's much more dangerous than, you know, you think it is. But it becomes very obvious once you jump in the water. Well, glad nobody died. So yeah.
Glad nobody died. And there's also, I also did want to mention too that Brendan McDonald, I don't know if a lot of our listeners know who Brendan McDonald was, but he was our president, St. Cloud State's president from 1982 to 1992. He held many administrative positions before that. I know most of the 70s he was at University of Nebraska, Kearney, I think that's how you pronounce it. Mm-hmm. But he was a student here, and he was a member of El Surat in 1952 when this had happened, and he's been, the information we found was that he's been described as the trainer of the swimmer to cross the Mississippi River. So I know I'm almost, it's either in the Chronicle or in the yearbook for that 52, 53, 54, and he graduated in 54, of him in the water training the swimmer. You know, he's got his pants rolled up to his knees, you know. So just saying, you know, a president had participated in this. He did not swim, but he was, you know,
he trained her. Yeah,
he trained the swimmers. So there's some great stuff about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and that's the neat thing I think about the university archives that maybe some current students don't realize what they do today is, you know, that's out there. It's recorded, and you know, this is all silly and in good fun, but yeah. You know, 30 years later, when you're the president of the university you graduated from, somebody's going to find your photo.
And there's lots of photos of Brian McDonald here at the University Archives. But just wanted to say, Brendan, you know, he participated in this, so I don't know what he thought about it later on. But he didn't mention it. You know, we have an oral history interview with him and his wife, Laverne, who was, I believe she was class of 53, and the oral history is interesting that he does not talk about much about him being president, though the oral history was done in 1982, and he must have been here just a few months as president, but he talks about his life, and his wife talks about their life as students here in the early 1950s, and he did not mention the swimming across the Mississippi River, but lots of other things that were going on at that time.
Nice. So shifting to one more topic for this morning. A very well-known Minnesotan definitely has some connections to St. Cloud State. And, you know, I've talked about that before here at KVSC. Sinclair Lewis has, his brother, I believe, taught here. He was a doctor here.
And he was a doctor, but he did not teach at the university. He was one of the folks who set up the St. Cloud Hospital. His name was Claude.
Yep, that's right. He didn't teach here. He just lived really close.
He lived really close.
Yep. And so the archives, you've got Sinclair Lewis's letters. What can you tell us about that?
Right. So this was a project that that we did a few years ago. I think it was 2008, 2009. And, Jeff, the University Archives here, our main focus is documenting the history of St. Cloud State University. We have other records not related to the university that were taken before I got here. But since I've been here, and I've been here since 2007, our main focus is documenting St. Cloud State University, making that material accessible, and helping anyone who has some questions about St. Cloud State University. But we do have things not related, including material of and about Sinclair Lewis, and as well as his brother Claude and Claude's family. The Claude Lewis papers were donated, or actually, I believe they were, I take that back, they were purchased from the family in the early 1970s, and then one of the daughters of Claude gave more papers in 1987. We have those here. Anyone can see them whenever they want. But because of that collection and that interest in Lewis, and, you know, he's a Stearns County, origin, it seems that people have given a material about Sinclair Lewis because we have other Lewis material here. And that includes these letters that he wrote to Marcella Powers from 1939 to 1947. And Lewis, when he met Marcella at the Provincetown Theater in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, was 54. And he was the narrator of the play Ah, Wilderness. And she was, I don't know if she was in the play or not, but she was 18 years old, Marcella Powers, and they immediately started a relationship. And these letters, they're 262 letters and one poem that we have here, really, I don't know, it documents his life. I mean, those 8 years that these letters were in. You know, it wasn't just some casual friend that Lewis knew. This was his intimate confidant, who they did have a relationship, but as time went on, it evolved into sort of a father-daughter relationship. But these letters were purchased by the university in the mid-1990s from this woman, Mary Branham, who was a friend of Marcella Powers, and she received those letters in 1985 when Powers passed away.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, if you think about that, well, once again, in today's terms, yeah, we send texts back and forth to people, but the idea of writing letters, you know, and just that vast quantity of letters, you know, back and forth, you know, that's well, that's how people, you know, connected with one another. You know, if you weren't next to, if you weren't in the same room or the same town, yeah, you wrote letters back and forth. And, you know, I think that in the age of texts and emails, we're missing some of that, you know, so.
Absolutely. And, yeah, I mean, the art of letter writing is disappeared. I mean, I have a box of letters that I received, you know, when I was a lot younger, and I wrote a lot of letters too, but I don't remember the last time I wrote a letter to anybody, and having that evidence of that activity, you know, yeah, with emails and texts, it's just poof, It's gone. But that's what's so fascinating about the Lewis letters. You know, you can come to University Archives, you can see the actual letters. So Jeff, if you want to see them when we're finished, I'll be happy to pull them out. But what's really important, this is the reason why I thought this would be a good thing to talk about, is as evidence, they're evidence of his life, of Lewis's life, what he was thinking at the time, what he was doing. You know, he's writing books, he was moving. You know, he lived in Excelsior for a while, Minnesota. He lived in Duluth for a while. He was in New York City. He was in Los Angeles. You know, he was talking about the writing of two of his books, Cass Timberlane and King's Blood Royal. But what makes them significant is, you know, anybody can come here during our office hours to see these, but all of these letters now are available online through Minnesota Reflections, the web portal for Minnesota Digital Library. And this was really the first primary source material of Lewis available on the web. And, I mean, there's a ton of stuff in Austin, Texas of his. There's a ton of stuff in Yale. But none of this was published. You know, the books were. You can get, you know, the stuff before 1923 is available that you can look at since it's public domain. But these letters and things like that he created are not. And I thought this would be a good opportunity to sort of make a splash since I was new when that happened, and to make these available in partnership with Minnesota Digital Library.
Uh-huh. And now it's part of the larger world.
It is, and it is, and it was a difficult process. I want to say it's difficult, but it was a laborious process because I was motivated enough to do it. I thought, you know, this is a good thing. People need to see this stuff and not have to, if they don't want to come to St. Cloud State University Archives, they can be sitting in their pajamas at 3 in the morning, you know, in New York City or wherever they're at, to be able to see this. And I had to work with the literary agents of Lewis, since even though Lewis has been dead since 1951, he still owns the copyright to those letters. And it was a bit of a learning curve for the literary agents, but in the end we got it done, and we were able to publish these. And the other piece that it just popped in my brain was I was in contact with John Paul Lewis, who was one of the grandsons of Sinclair, and I had asked him, as the first person I talked to, and I said, what would you think if we made these available? And he's like, absolutely, I want to see these out there. This is a great idea. And if he would have said, you know what, this isn't a good idea, we would have stopped. Mm-hmm. But he supported it, and he helped us get that approval from the literary agents to make these available to anyone at any time.
Nice. Well, thanks for talking with me today, Don.
You're welcome, Jeff. Anytime.
Once again, you've been listening to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. And today we've been talking with Tom Stamen, SDSU archivist. For access to the archive online, you can go to the library website at St. Cloud State University at libsys.stcloudstate.edu/archon/index. And that'll take you to the Archon portal. Or you can link to it off of our website under this podcast at kvsc.org under the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota link. Or you could climb to the top floor of the Miller Learning Resource Center and talk to Tom Stamen yourself. He and all the history that the St. Cloud State Archive has to offer would enjoy the conversation. This has been Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack, and the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota is made possible through funding by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and has been produced at KVSC, a proud member of AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities.